you can try. I've got line of sight.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode number 2 of True Line of Sight. My name's Chandler. I'm here with Jaden.
Indeed. It's pretty good. It's pretty good. Very I can breathe again. That's good.
Breathing is good. I hear good things about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to be kicking to our second episode. The first thing we want to talk a little bit about, though, is just some fun. What are we playing? What are we up to lately? Which you've been playing, Jay?
So I've been playing Custodes, which is weird because I've basically played 3 games that weren't Chaos Knights before this. Mm. Yeah, it's been interesting. Hitting on 2s feels really good, man.
Yeah. And like rerolling ones playing, like 90% of the time.
Right, because I've been playing in Emissaries and Paradis. And I just, you know, I ignore all the hit and wound modifiers, so my Sagittarum camp out next to Trajan and blow things up every turn. And it's great.
Like you do.
Yeah, just like 2 units taking out a Great Unclean one at range, no big deal. So I play 2 games now, both into demons. Both games have gone about the same. Largely speaking, the Great Unclean one has died turn 1, and so my opponent is taking that out of his list, which I think is probably the correct play. Mm. And then I've sort of like dealt with Bellicor and then his Bloodthirster in that order, because the Bloodthirster with the wound gates is gnarly.
Yeah, it just takes the longest to deal with by definition, right?
Yeah. And then he keeps charging my stuff with like demonets or bloodletters, and I keep going, oh no, my Sagittarum, and then he keeps killing like 1 Sagittarum, and then I kill half the unit back, and I'm like, oh. Alright.
Yeah, it seems alright.
Yeah. So yeah, it's been really good. I am learning how to use infantry, and it's weird.
Yeah.
So, yeah. How about yourself?
Well, I've been kind of all over the place, to be honest.
Yeah, you have.
Yeah, because, well, so the main thing is I kind of made the call that I wanted to get into mainly playing demons, which I already have like a chunk of demon stuff, largely just like Zinch and Khorne stuff. But I'm kind of like slowly trying to get my hands on a bunch of like Slaanesh demon stuff that I feel like I would really like to have for playing the faction. Just a lot of like demonettes, fiends, if you can find them.
So good.
Good luck. Yeah, demonettes are just very, very good. Yeah, so just kind of figuring it out, and but because I don't have all the stuff that I need and I need to take time to paint it and whatnot for events coming up, I've kind of landed on playing Chaos Knights. I just feel like they're in a really good spot right now, just generally speaking, which is great. And yeah, so I kind of got back in touch with you about the Herpetrax list we had kind of been working on for a long time. And kind of what our current version of that sort of looks like, and been playing around with that a little bit. But I've only had the 1 practice game with it, although, boy, I've just been having a lot of time making Lehman Russ's blow up and kill all of his troops. That's just been a consistent factor of the games I've played for a little while, which is pretty funny. Do. Yeah, I had a great one yesterday where I took 4 Lehman Russes and a Rogal Dorn to the face of my Desecrator with Blessing of the Dark Master and took 2 damage because he just rolled really bad. It was like, neat. Yeah, it was pretty funny. But yeah, it was good. Chaos Knights is, I mean, that was kind of the first faction I ever really played like competitively per se. Right. Yeah. Like actually at tournaments. And so it's kind of, you know, if it's like, it's like riding a bike, right? You just
a little bit. Yeah. Nothing else is quite like them.
Yeah. They're definitely their own thing. But yeah. So that's kind of where we're at the moment. As far as news, what's going on? So we had the Meta Watch not that long ago, which is always cool. I think this is just a really awesome thing that they showcase, but being able to kind of break down all the factions and like their win percentages like that. They make a big deal about kind of getting everything into that like 45 to 55% win weight range. And I can speak. And they've actually done pretty well. It's actually pretty wild how closely balanced a lot of things are. I do think there are always kind of weird things, like they still wrap Iron Hands in with Adeptus Astartes.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. Like on their own, yeah. I think Iron Hand somewhere between like a 56% and 60% win rate, depending on your data source.
Yeah, right. And
which is wild.
Yeah, so like, which putting Adeptus Astartes at 47%, and then the fact that they also like they do that, but then they don't have like certain
space
other
space wolves.
Yeah, space wolves. I believe Blood Angels. They put in their
Blood
own
Angels,
thing.
Dark Angels, Death Watch.
Yeah. And like if Dark Angels were in there, the percentage would just like crank right up, right? Because Dark yes. Angels are doing pretty good, it turns out. Who would have thought? Yeah, it's a pretty cool balance situation that we're in. I do think one thing that I actually also quite like is that the meta watch, like when they actually go in and talk about it, they do a pretty good job kind of breaking down like why they think things are the way they are, and like a lot of the ideas about like Gene Stealer cults in particular make a lot of sense to me, where they're kind of a weird faction that can benefit a lot from a lot of the changes that happened, but right. also probably it takes more time to learn to play against them than it does to kind of play them in a mm-hmm. situation like this.
Right.
So like they might be a little bloated right now. I know my friend who's getting into Gene Stealer cults was saying the community is just like blaming it heavily on like a handful of very good players, and like they're gonna get us nerfed. Which I thought was pretty funny.
That was pretty great. Yeah.
But
I just love how I accidentally am a power gamer because all three factions that I have are in the top eight. Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. That is true.
And all that really matters is that Chaos Knights is above Imperial Knights, which is where they should be.
Yeah, get wrecked, imps.
Yep.
But yeah.
Sorry, not sorry. Yep. The other thing that was interesting about that is I believe in that MetaWatch like video, they mentioned that the next balance thing is coming in probably April, mm-hmm. and that it's not going to be like points changes, it's going to be data sheet changes, which I'm kind of all here for, because data sheet changes are cool.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, for sure.
Shake up the game. Let's do it.
Yep. Yeah, I'm excited to see what they do with that. It should be pretty cool. But the just
make all the big knights way better than they currently are, please. Let's start with
just here to crank them. Get Chaos Knights even stronger, please.
Because we need it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the general sort of format of kind of how we're wanting to do things is that we are going to be sort of taking turns like talking about stuff. Yep. And this week it's Jaden. Jaden's in control. He's taking the helm.
I am.
What are we talking about?
So today we're going to talk about the charge phase and the fight phase. And we're going to talk about like why this is the part of the game that is in many ways the most complex and interesting. And we're just going to take it from like the beginning, and we're going to go to the end. And so like brief overview here time. Hopefully we've got a nice little graphic up at this point. There's the charge phase where you can charge stuff. And then there's heroic interventions is the second part of the charge phase. Then you hit the fight phase where there's a bunch of different the rules about fighting first, fighting regularly, fighting last. And then you get to when you've chosen to fight, you pile in, you make your attacks, and then you consolidate. And then there's interrupting. And then that just happens until the end of the fight phase when everything has successfully fought. So it sounds pretty simple, but it is deceptively very much not at all. And yeah, we're gonna break that down a little bit here. So I guess we start with the charge phase, right?
Mm-hmm.
So charge phase, you got some important rules to follow, basically. First of all, something that always weirded me out coming from other games is that to charge something, you don't need to be able to see it.
Yeah.
It's very weird to me still, but that's a thing. This is really important because during the charge phase, infantry that can breach through breachable terrain can still just breach through breachable terrain. No problem. And that's very important because a number of rules that interact with charges, such as Overwatch, do require line of sight. And if you start your charge in obscuring terrain that they can't see you in, you can't be overwatched by whatever you're charging.
Right.
It's a very powerful rule against things that have flamers because you don't want to get flamed usually when you're charging. It's bad times.
Yeah.
So that's a, you know, a nice little thing there. There are a couple restrictions. First of all, you can't currently be engaged by anything. If you're engaged, I don't actually think you can move at all until the pile and consolidate steps.
No, yeah,
of the turn.
You're not able to.
So you can't be engaged. The other thing is your target must be within 12 inches of you and 5 inches vertically, but you can charge more than 12 inches with a lot of stuff. So sometimes people that can take 3d6 charges try to target things that are like 14 or 15 inches away for a long bomb, and you just have to be like, no, you can't do that.
Right.
Yeah, so you basically pick a unit to charge with. You roll 2d6 dice, or 2d6, yes. And that number is the number of inches that that unit can move. There's a couple of really important things here. Just like the movement phase, you cannot move through engagement range of anything that isn't your target, which is something that I think people forget about a fair amount. It's certainly something that I forgot about because I play knights and most of my stuff that charges doesn't care about that rule.
Right.
But, you know, that's kind of an interesting thing that I want to play around with some more, because there's a, like, that makes screening things potentially more useful than I originally considered them to be. Because if you can make a gap where the thing's base can't fit through between like terrain and the model, maybe in the engagement range, they just can't make the charge, which is interesting. I've got to play around with that concept a little bit more now that I'm playing infantry stuff. And then to be successful, you have to roll a number that allows you to get within 1 inch of your target, which is engagement range. Now, a lot of people get engagement range confused. Engagement range is always 1 inch, but there are special rules that will, there is a special rule in the fight phase that lets models in a unit fight things that aren't within an inch of them with some circumstances. So that's where that misunderstanding comes in within, but engagement range is always 1 inch. Yeah, there are some important other caveats here. So flight doesn't work like you think it does during the charge phase. In the movement phase, you can move over buildings and all terrain and models.
And you essentially ignore up and down, right? You ignore
the concept pretty much.
Yeah.
I think flight also allows you to move through engagement ranges, but I can't be 100% certain on that one because I'm still getting used to models that fly. The other thing is, during the charge phase, you only ignore models. You cannot charge through stuff unless you can breach and have fly, and even then you can't breach through like containers and things. So this is a big deal, obviously, because things like like the Bloodthirster, for example, can't just charge over a ruin to get at you. It has to charge around the ruin, or it has to climb over the ruin, which is probably not happening with its base being as big as it is. Yeah, so that's a weird little quirk. You said you had like a little anecdote for why that
was. Yeah, so this is actually, I learned about this from a Tactical Tortoise video actually a while back, where it was just like weird rules you might not know about. So, all right, especially on like TTS, you'll see them play sometimes with buildings that are very, very tall. And so, you know how generally speaking, when you deep strike, you have to be outside of 9 inches?
Oh, no.
So let's say that you had a building so tall that you were able to deep strike 9 inches above something, but within about 1.5 inches of it, like side, like horizontally.
Sure.
This would give you a like 1 inch charge if you could fly while charging, if you were a flying model after you deep strike. Okay. So things, it was this very corner case situation where you could use verticality to shorten your deep strike charge distances. So, and even then, even with a shorter building, I mean, it doesn't have to be very tall before you're getting like an 8, possibly even 7 inch charge,
right?
If you're dealing with like an extreme diagonal, so it just kind of makes sure that you kind of have to deal with the 9 inch charge one way or another.
That's fair. Yeah,
it's kind of a funny, weird corner case thing where it's like, why do you lose flight when you're charging? And it's like, well, because jank, mostly because janky stuff, don't worry about it.
That makes sense, I guess. Yeah, I mean, I could see that being a big problem with demons too, right? Like you can warp strike in or deep strike in 6 inches so many different ways.
Yeah
All right, that's a pretty valid reason. Okay, so yeah, there you go. That's why you can't charge over buildings if you have flight.
Yep.
Yeah, so the other thing is, and we're going to be looking here at this picture of the Abominant facing down the Dreadnought at this point. We've got a measurement here of about 7 inches distance between them, technically. Now, this is an Abominant that's got most of its base behind a piece of terrain that it can't just walk through. Mm-hmm. And so this is, like, for almost anything that isn't a big oval-shaped base, this is a pretty easy charge. It's like a 7 or maybe an 8-inch charge. However, I've measured it out. So the way that oval bases work is every time you rotate the base, you have to account for that much movement in the movement itself. This is a thing that I think 40K players in general, and myself included, honestly, I didn't even pay attention to this rule until 6-8 months ago when I started trying to clean up my play, ignore or don't understand properly. So what it turns out as, first you have to like rotate your base about an inch to just even get to a line where you can move around the building. And then you get a 3-inch movement before you have to start rotating your base again, because the thing's base is too big to fit between those two buildings that direction. So after another 3-inch rotation, so now we're at 7 inches and we've moved 3 towards the target, we can then continue moving. However, let's say we rolled a 12 to charge, so we get 5 extra inches of movement. That doesn't actually end us in melee with the Dreadnought. And it's not even close. It's close to 3 inches away. Now, obviously, this is like a huge edge case because knight bases are ridiculous. But there's tons of oval bases in the game. Anything with a bike pretty much has an oval base at this point. A lot of the demons do. A lot of the cavalry does. A lot of the little monster things like flesh hounds will. Even some weird things like Ivrain, who's a character solo for Eldari, she's just got a big long cloak dragon behind her. Her base is an oval. And this can really screw up your plans if you haven't accounted for this in your planning phase of things. If you have to rotate an inch, so let's say that you had a 7-inch charge, right? That's like a 58%, something close to 70%, 75% with a reroll. If you have to rotate an inch, that's an 8-inch charge now. That's only like a 40%. And with a reroll, it's like 60. So, I mean, you still got better than average if you have a reroll. But if you don't, you're not looking at less than a coin flip. If it was already an 8-inch charge and you're looking at a 9 now, you're looking at something like 32% range. And it just gets worse from there. Even something like from a 4 to a 5, your odds of success go down by a lot. Like somewhere between 10 and 15% per increment that you move up. Mm-hmm. And I don't think a lot of people are playing this in the correct way, thinking about this. It's certainly like, because it feels really bad, you know, having to do all of this. And it also, it's not a cultural thing in 40K to have proxy bases around, which are the things that make this really easy to calculate. It's something that I think I'm going to start carrying around with me is proxy bases, because I've got bikes that I'm playing. If I've got custodes, I've got, obviously for knights, the big bases are huge. And, you know, it's just kind of a big problem if you're not prepared for it and your opponent goes, well, actually, this is how this works. And then everybody feels bad, right? Like, because your opponent feels like a jerk for having to screw your plans up. The TO feels bad because somebody's made a mistake. And you feel bad because you're probably going to lose whatever that thing was now when you fail your charge.
Yeah.
And nobody really likes that. So, yeah, just if you're playing a faction with a lot of ovaloid bases in it, maybe brush up on this. Because it is, you know, it's an important part of, I think, the balancing of some of these models. You know, bikes, big knights, they're very fast, they get places quickly, and then you can set up these charges. But part of that is also they can't move through terrain when they charge, and they're supposed to have to maneuver around it.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Has that been a thing like you've had to particularly worry about? This is also true for things like vehicles, right? Like tanks, if they're ever charging or maneuvering around stuff, right? Because they can't just change their positioning willy-nilly, so they're kind of rectangular boxes.
Yes, yeah, no, and I do agree with you. And this is so one thing that like is kind of funny, a lot of people probably know, but so we came from War Machine background, right? So we came from both a game that is kind of notoriously a little bit anal about movement, yes. But also doesn't have weird shaped bases, right? Everything is circular. Yep. And circular, real easy to work with, turns out. Whereas any kind of like ovoid causes some really weird things because, yeah, the movement is based on any part of your base moving.
Yep. Right?
And I think, yeah, I think about 99% of people are like pretty lax about this. Mm-hmm. And like, honestly, and again, this is breaking things down in a very like thorough way. I think in like most casual games, it probably doesn't matter that much, but it is something to catch out. Like if you're at like, you know, a higher or trying to push towards higher end tables or things like that, you could get yourself mm-hmm. caught by this.
Yes.
If somebody's like, hey, yeah, you have to charge a lot further than you think you do. Yeah. Yeah, this is one area where, yeah, having like a proxy base to help yourself out can be enormously helpful. But yeah, you definitely do need to account for it. Anytime you're using kind of any kind of an oval, a lot of people kind of will just move things kind of however. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of the time, like, I'm going to be honest, a lot of the time it's like, whatever. Yep. But just don't let yourself get caught out in a situation where, like, this is a really important charge and you could technically get caught on a technicality, right?
Yep. Absolutely. So yeah, it's just something to think about. And I'm actually kind of thinking really hard about getting like either official bases or like the measurements and having somebody cut me some proxy bases out of MDF with a laser cutter. Cause mm-hmm. I think especially cause I tend to play more elite model count armies. I'm at the point where I kind of want to be holding myself to a slightly higher standard than maybe I have been. And just making sure that everything is super clean on that front. Cause it could, you know, it's not a good feeling to accidentally be giving yourself extra movement when you shouldn't.
Yeah.
So, sure. Yeah. One other thing you should probably think about when you're in the charge phase is a lot of factions have access to something called Tanglefoot Grenade or something very similar to it. Basically, this is just a thing where they get to roll some number of dice and reduce your charge distance by that much. That's a very powerful rule. Like, it's difficult to understate how much the difference in that is. I think probably at some point in here, I'm going to put a probability chart of rolling at least a certain number on a 2d6. But you can see that every one higher you have to go, your odds get much lower. And the expected return from a reroll also gets worse. So as we mentioned like earlier, 7 on a 2d6 is 56-58%, somewhere in that range. And on a reroll, it's somewhere between 75-80% in that ballpark. Whereas like, 12 is what, 1 out of 36, and with a reroll it's 1.5 out of 36, right? Like, it doesn't actually get that much better for you. Mm-hmm. And that scales exponentially rather than linearly, so it gets worse much faster than you think it does. It's not a straight line of, oh, this is bad. There's other things like, also, if you have to touch rough terrain or difficult ground, or things that have a similar effect. And then, of course, things that can have or mess with your charge distances, Chaos Knights is always on my brain. One of their things is they can half your charge distances if you fail a dread test. The number of games I've won off that is large. Yeah. And yeah,
it's a huge benefit for sure.
Yeah. So just, you know, things to be aware of when you're planning out your turn and your charges, it's maybe worth asking your opponent, like, can you reduce my charge distances? And they'll reply, and then you'll know whether or not, and you can take that into your plans. A couple other things about charges. This is a lot more complicated than I thought it was going to be.
Charge and fight phase is in general, to be honest.
So. Yeah, it is. And I love it, but it's a lot of talking. So you have the option to charge multiple things in the fight phase, which is really interesting. And can do some crazy things. But there's also some times where it's like not quite obvious why you should do that. So I'm looking here at a picture of the Abominant facing down an Achilles Dreadnought and a Sagittarum. And the thing is, if you look at this picture that I'm about to put on the screen, but the next one for you, Chandler, where the Dreadnought and the Sagittarum and the base are, The Abominant can't actually get into the zone, or sorry, to the objective, without being in combat with the Sagittarum. This is very important because you can't end your charge movement in engagement range of anything that you didn't charge either. So by placing like that, and let's just imagine here for a second that the Sagittarum is actually something scary that the knight cares about. You know, if you've effectively body blocked like this, you force your opponent to go for, say, a 5-inch charge instead of a 4-inch charge, which we've already mentioned is like a 10%-ish worse chance of working. So that's important. And then if your opponent wants to not do that, the next slide here, it's now looking like an 8-inch charge because you have to move 8 inches forward and 1 inch into the objective. Now, that one's a little bit easier because you can pile in and consolidate that direction as well.
Yeah, there's other ways around that.
But just like in general, you know, it's a way to body block off objectives or important choke points. And so that's why you might want to multi-charge. The other thing is there's some really cool tricks that we're going to talk about later that will make it so the multi-charging looks a lot more attractive than it might have once done if the odds are not super against you. Because, you can do some wild stuff if you've got two things in combat with you. So end of the charge phase, you have to be successfully engaging the thing that you charged. So that's within an inch, and you can't end an engagement of things except the charge target. And then we get to the heroic intervention step. Which is a whole nother thing. So, one real quick thing. The other thing about terrain, like you can charge over it when you charge, you just have to climb it, which is the distance up, the distance over, the distance down, and your base size. So if it's 3 inches up, 3 inches over, 3 inches down, that's a 9-inch charge. If you're base to base with it and your base is 2 inches, that means you have to roll an 11. So it's not happening is basically my rule of thumb. So heroic interventions. After everything is charged, and this is important, it happens at the end of everything. You don't just like, you charged and now heroically intervene. Characters and some other things that are within 3 inches of an enemy unit but aren't engaged can heroically intervene, which is basically they move 3 inches or up to 3 inches, and then they're in combat. There's a couple really important things about heroic intervention movement and pile in and consolidate. Namely, difficult ground penalties don't apply to them, and a lot of negatives to movement and charge effects also don't apply to them because they apply specifically to your movement characteristic or to your charge roll. And heroic interventions, piles in, and consolidates do not care about that. They don't use your move characteristic, and they aren't charge rolls. So, also important about heroic intervention, you don't actually have to end in combat. And this is, I think, an understated thing. You can just move up to 3 inches, and you just have to be closer to the closest enemy model than you were. So this might be really useful for, say, like, maybe there's another combat happening and a character with a subtract to hit or minus one attack or some other penalty, like a plus armor or no rerolls or take your pick aura, wasn't quite in range of that combat before. They can move 2 inches with heroic intervention, and now they're in, but they don't have to be in combat and risk themselves. Also, if there's anything with fight first, that can be really scary when heroically intervene, because now you have to think about what you're going to do. And there's also some other, when it says character, it means like literally any character. So it could be a gigantic chaos knight. It could be a demon. It could be any of those things.
Yeah, the amount of times I've had people get caught out by the fact that the gigantic, you know, knight desecrator or whatever is like, yeah, heroically intervenes in, and you're like, uh-oh. You're like,
yeah,
I forgot that's a character. You're like, yep. Boy, is it.
Yep. Yeah, and it's always like, and so, you know, there's a calculation to be made about heroic interventions, like, am I throwing my character away? But the way that I tend to think about it is, at very least, I want to move 2 inches to an at, like, 2 inches-ish, right?
Yeah,
that
seems good. Quite get into combat, yeah.
And at very best, it's like, well, you sent a few elite guys into one thing, and you can't kill both of these things, so you have to choose between the objective secured unit or this other thing that's a character, and whichever one you choose, you're going to die on the backswing. So it also, like, it potentially unengages multiple units for the next turn through combat. It can do things like reclaim zones if characters have objective secured or strip objective secured auras. There's just a myriad applications for this rule, especially because if you think about, so like, let's take a hypothetical with a character that fights first. Opponent makes multiple charges, character heroically intervenes. And it has some sort of debilitating aura. Opponent fights somewhere, that character then piles in, that's up to 3 inches, fights, and then consolidates up to 3 more inches. They've now moved potentially 9 inches towards the thing that they want to apply their aura to, and suddenly, like, that fight is dramatically different.
Or just, I mean, let's take, like, a boogeyman that's been around for a while. Take, like, Abaddon, right? Like, mm-hmm. nobody wants Abaddon to be 9 inches closer to their army than he was before, right?
Right.
Yep. At the start, going into the start of their turn, too. So, like, you're like, yeah. Oh. Like, yeah.
It's also really important that you can heroically intervene into anything. It doesn't have to have charged. So this actually got me out a lot when I was learning how to play the game. I would
advance. Oh, I got obliterated. Yeah, I got wrecked by Trajan. Yep. Because of it, because Trajan's 6-inch heroic intervenes.
Yep.
Like, he's coming for you. Yeah, you park
Trajan on an objective, and it's like, well, you advanced to get here.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, I did. And it's like, okay, I'm just gonna heroically intervene into you. And I'm like, oh.
Yeah, it wasn't even that. I literally just like, yeah, this knight'll be here. And it was just like 5 inches from Trajan. It's just like, yep. Oh, uh-oh.
Like, yeah. So there are some things you might want to consider. So far, questions you should be asking your opponent. In the fight phase or in the charge phase, do you have ways to reduce my charges? Like before your turn gets to this point. And then during the charge phase, before you charge, there should be like, where are your heroic interventions, and do you have ways to make them bigger? Because again, those are both things that will absolutely dramatically change the game if you don't pay attention to them.
Yep.
Okay. We have now gotten to the fight phase.
We did it.
We did it. So there's 3 parts to the fight phase. And then there's some exceptions to this. There's the fight first step. Things that fight first are models that charged, they always considered to be fighting first, and models that always say fight that
first. They fight first, yeah.
Yep.
Models that fight first include models that fight first.
Yep. There's also a few things like some weird edge case rules say, like, you get the benefits of having charged this turn, even if you don't.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that. So those are things that are considered to be fighting first. Now, in the fight first phase, well, I'll talk about that in a second. Then there's the normal fighting phase, where everything that is in combat that did not charge and does not have fight first get to fight. And then there is fights last. And the fight last phase is for anything that had a fight last effect applied to it and did not have some source of fight first applied to it already. Because they cancel out and you end up in the normal fight phase if you did that. So, in the fight first phase, the player whose turn it is gets to decide what fights at the beginning. And then if there are opponent models that fight first as well, they get to then alternate back and forth, but the person whose turn it in goes first. In the normal fight phase, the person whose turn it is not chooses the first fight, which is another rule that screwed me over repeatedly when I was learning to play the game, because it didn't feel very right to me. But I've gotten over that.
Well, like, cause yeah. So like tactically, this is one thing to always think about. And this, when I thought about it this way, it made me realize like how strong this can be, which is that if you charge something and you fail to kill it, generally speaking, it's going to get to fight you twice before you get to fight again. Right. And thinking about it that way, it makes you understand like the power dynamic of going into a fight.
Yep. Absolutely. And then in the fight last phase, the person whose turn it is again gets to choose who goes first, because if there's a core rule that says if 2 players have things that resolve at the same time, the active player gets to choose the order. So it is very rare to have multiple fights last things happening, but it can happen, I guess, potentially.
Two silent kings fighting each other.
Oh yeah, gosh, that would be that would be interesting. Okay, so the fight phase. The first thing that happens is you choose somebody to fight with. And the way you choose somebody to fight with has 2 specific parameters that are very important and also separate. First, anything that has something in melee range of it or engagement range is eligible to fight. Or, this is an and or, anything that made a charge move in the same turn is eligible to fight. Those are very important that they are separate things, which we're going to talk more about in a second here. But it's just really important to know that both of those are, you know, conditions that you can be in where you are allowed to fight. The first thing that happens is you make a pile-in movement, which is a 3-inch move with all of your models in the unit. This is really important because models in units are allowed to fight if they're within 1/2 inch of a model that is within 1/2 inch of an opponent's model. This is like the pile-in phase is kind of the thing that enables this. And that honestly, this is where a lot of people's like a nuance of the pile-in step kind of ends, because it's just sort of the obvious use for it. If you ended up exactly at 1 inch with like one model out of a 5-man unit, you will almost guaranteed be able to get in. Actually, you will be guaranteed to be able to get in with all 5 of those models. Just the math, I guess, unless you're like in a big old line, like, yeah, like 2 inches max apart, then you could only get in with 3 or maybe 4 of them, but that's probably never going to happen, or it's rarely going to happen.
Yeah, it's come up for me before, but it's not common.
Yeah, like, I'm trying to think. You'd have to be in a pretty big, long, spread-out line, and then maybe, like, after the first 3 or... Like, if you have a 10-man unit, and this happens, and you're all spread out in line through, like, a choke point, I could see it so that it restricts it to, like, 3 or 4 models fighting instead of all 10, but it's pretty hard for that to happen. Yeah. However, there are some really important things about piling in that don't get talked about very much. I'm going to actually read the pile-in rules, because they matter. It says, when a unit piles in, you can move each model in that unit up to 3 inches. This is a pile-in move, which is important because that means it ignores things like difficult ground. Each model in this unit must finish this pile-in move closer to the closest enemy model. A model that is already touching an enemy model cannot move, but still counts as having piled in. Remember that a unit must finish any type of move in unit coherency. Okay, there's a couple of really important things missing from that. First of all, it doesn't say that it can't end in melee range or engagement range of units that it didn't start in. If you go look at the wording for charge, it says, every unit, engagement range of every unit that was in the target of its charge without moving within engagement range of any enemy models that were not part of its charge. And if you look at regular movement, which I'm doing... Man, it is so nice that Arx and Nephilim both had all of the core rules in the back.
Yeah, the Grand Tournament packs having those back there is really nice.
Yep. So,
because I don't have a core rule book.
Right. Okay. So, there's a portion in here that I'm import. Okay. No model move can be within engagement range of enemy models. That's for normal move. That's for advance. And that's for fallback.
Yeah, it spells that out.
It spells that out. Everywhere that is true is spelled out. Pile-in doesn't care. This is really important because we're going to talk about this. We might as well talk about it now. There's some things that you can do in the fight phase where if you charge, left yourself about the full inch of movement and pile in, you can end, say, 3/4 of an inch away from your charge target and 1/2 inch away from a much less scary thing. Fight the charge target, because it's the only thing you can fight, and then consolidate, which says also you must move towards the closest enemy model, towards the thing you weren't charging, which is really, really strong. First of all, you move like 6 inches. Second of all, the only things that are eligible to fight in the fight phase are models that charged, like yours, or things that are engagement range of other enemy models. And if your charge target is no longer in engagement range of enemy models, it can't fight. So it can't chase you, because being able to pile in and consolidate is part of being chosen to fight. So we're going to show some, we've been showing some pictures on the screen of why this matters. And you'll be able to see a dreadnought charging a Chaos Knight and then running away to engage a ranged war dog that has 4 strength, 6 attacks at AP 0. You know, not hurting a dreadnought. But this is the kind of thing that really matters and makes the fight phase such an intricate, layered little dance. Because this is true for every single combat. Which is why when we talk about interrupting here in a little bit, that matters a lot more than I think a lot of people think it does as far as just killing stuff. So, the combat sequence. First, you roll your attacks. You have to do this at, like, you can roll at most all of the attacks by one weapon type from a unit at once. You can also roll as few as every attack individually in a unit at once. there is a lot of variance between when you should do these things, I think. So I'm trying to collect my thoughts here to the most organized. I'm going to continue the combat sequence, then I'll come back to why you should think about different ways to group this. Once you have made your attack or attacks your opponent, you then have to make your wound rolls. This is based on the chart, which says basically that if your strength of your weapon is double their toughness, you wound on twos. If it's more than their toughness, you wound on threes. If it's equal, you wound on fours. If it's less than, you wound on fives. And if it's half or less than that, you wound on sixes. And then they make their saves, which are modified by the armor penetration value of your attack and potentially invulnerable saves or demon saves or lots of other saves. I'm actually a lot less interested in talking about this part because everybody kind of understands how it works.
Yep.
But, you know, that's an important thing. That's how the sequence works. Then any wounds that do go through do damage. Then any mortal wounds that come from the attack do damage after that. And your opponent gets any things that ignores wounds, like feel no pains, at the point at which they take the damage. So,
yeah, that is just, I just want to call out the thing that, because I have seen people mess this up a little bit. Mm-hmm. It's just not always clear because it's not really spelled out in the rule text of the weapons usually. Mm-hmm. But mortal wounds are after everything else.
Yes.
99% of the time, I've seen people get this correct, but I've seen it throw off people occasionally. Mm-hmm. Where they think it's done like
first
before or like yeah. during somehow. Yeah, it's the last thing that happens is basically when you're allocating wounds, it's like the last thing.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. So that's mortal wounds are at the end of it, and then feel no pains. So most 40K players will just take all of the kind of attack that they're making and take them all at one time. That's usually okay, but there's some cases where I think it's very suboptimal. Like, for example, if you're shooting a bunch of damage to weapons at a unit of Marines and one of them is in cover, I would probably shoot those attacks one at a time until that Marine is dead, because if my opponent's going to use their CP reroll at any point, it will be on that guy. And I want to then just be able to roll the rest of them after the fact, so they're all in the same save. Because one of two things is going to happen here. Either your opponent's going to have to then slow roll their dice after you've made all of your wounds, or you are, and in which case they have a lot more information about how many wounds are coming and whether or not they should use their CP reroll here. Like, let's say that you wounded them four times. They save, fail, and they go, well, I could spend a CP here and save on a one better save, or I could let it through, right? Like, that's so many more.
I can let it through because I don't have to make any more saves after this anyway.
Right. So stuff like that.
Now. I mean, yeah.
Which I think is kind of like, you know, it's a finicky thing to think about, but it does actually dramatically change the information your opponent has access to at the time that they're making their saves with their CP rules, or for something like Miracle Dice, or for something like Eldar Strands of Fate, or for Harlequin's Luck of the Laughing God. Like, any of these resources that let you mess with dice, you should consider when you want to let them have that much information. Now, a lot of times it doesn't matter. Like, I'm making 60 bolter shots at you. Great. Just do it.
Yeah.
Right.
Nine times out of 10, just roll all your damn dice. Like, there's not really a reason to be too finicky about it.
Yeah. But like,
there are just weird little,
say you're shooting with like the Diominus, which is a gigantic laser cannon, onto something that has an invuln and an access to like a reroll or to an auto save or something like that. Slow rolling them means that your opponent has to decide what the probabilities of you making the next wound is, and the one after that potentially too. So it just gives you a lot more room. It gives your opponent a lot more room to mess up, basically, is what I'm saying. And in a game where you're trying to find those little advantages, that's kind of an edge case thing. Another place that it might be important is if your opponent... So, okay, this is going to be really finicky, but like, let's take for Sagittarum, for example, because they're a unit I'm familiar with. Each model in the unit gets a strength 5 AP 3 damage 3 shot and 3 strength 5 AP 1 damage 2 shots. And let's say you're shooting at a pile of Terminators, like Word Bears Terminators, for example, Chandler, that have a, is it 5 up feel no pain?
Into mortal wounds.
Oh, just in mortal wounds.
Oh, well, Chaos Marine Terminators usually end up having a 5-up field.
Oh, right. Yeah,
because of Marcus Lanesh and the Light Flag.
Okay. So let's just say that that's epic, right? So in this particular instance, it is not a good idea to shoot all of your damage three weapons at once, because what will happen is they'll fail like two of them, and then the two damage three weapons will only kill one guy, because they'll like feel no pain one of the first three, and then the second one will kill it. But if you shoot like one Sagittarum at a time, so you connect with the three damage attack, say they feel no pain at once, and then you connect with two damage attacks, that's a lot more efficient, because the first one will die and the second one will take some damage. So things like that, thinking about the correct way to sequence your way through your attack steps, and obviously this isn't combat, but you get the idea. It could work there too if you've got different weapon profiles.
Do you not have to complete one weapon completely before you move on to a different weapon?
Oh, in combat? No, you were correct about combat. Yep.
Yeah.
But not for shooting. You shoot by model usually. And by weapon inside the model.
Do you really?
Let's double check. We weren't going to talk about the shooting phase today, but...
Yeah, because my understanding was always that, but it's, again, this is one of those things that is why I've always just kind of gone with how people have played it, is that you need to basically complete, like you go, these weapons are firing, then these weapons are firing. But then again, I've usually thought about that more from, as far as like multiple weapons firing like that, it's usually from a single model. Like I think about like dreadnoughts and stuff like mm-hmm. that. In which case, I believe you would definitely have to do it that way.
Okay, so here we go. If a model has more than one ranged weapon, it can shoot all in the same target, or it can split the weapons between different enemy units. Similarly, if a unit has more than one model, they can shoot at the same or different targets. In either case, you declare a target unit, you must declare which weapons will target that unit before any attacks are resolved. So you have to you can differentiate between weapons, and you can differentiate between models. So you should be able to do both.
Interesting.
So, I mean, that's how I would approach shooting Terminators with Sagittarum, right? Like, that makes way more sense to me. What do you think?
Oh, I didn't know that it worked that way. I genuinely thought you had to fire all of one type of weapon and then move on to the next type of weapon. No. But if it breaks down model by model, then I mean, yeah, that's how you would want to do it.
Yeah. So in combat, this is obviously less important, but I'm just talking about like why you would group your attacks in different ways and the way you'd roll them out. So there's that. That took a lot longer than I expected that bullet point to. We're going to then talk about removing models from a unit and why that's important. So I'm showing here on my screen, hopefully, a unit of five Terminators fighting a War Dog and an Abominant. And in the next picture, we're assuming here that the Abominant is fighting the Terminators, and that the Terminators charged the Abominant because they didn't kill it, because they wouldn't. The Terminator player has removed the two Terminators that were outside the zone and has left three Terminators in the zone, which is kind of like, I think, a reflex that a lot of people would have.
Yeah.
But that lets the War Dog attack still and move, because piling in. So what you should do instead in this case is remove the Terminators that are engaging the War Dog, because if the War Dog didn't charge, or the other thing didn't charge, and there's nothing engaging it when it's their turn to fight, then they don't get to fight at all.
Yeah.
And so they don't get
to pile in. And like, even if it did, like in this case, even if it did charge, like say you had your unit spread out enough that when you pick up the models, it just can't get back into engagement range, even with a pile in. Mm-hmm. Like that can happen, and suddenly it just can't get any attacks. Like it gets to scoot up a bit, but mm-hmm. it's not going to kill you, and you've still got your unit going into the next turn.
Right, and that's super doable within the math, because the consolidation range is, or the pylon's 3 inches, the engagement range is one, so that's four. But let's say that you had mm-hmm. Terminators 1 inch away from it, plus their base size, which is 1.35 something inches, and then a 2 inch distance between the guy and the next guy. That is 4.3-ish inches away. You're going to be outside of engagement range at the end of that. So picking up, like a lot of people just default to, I'm going to keep my good in melee guys, or I'm going to keep my bad at whatever this other thing is guys. But removing the things that stop your opponent from fighting is the most efficient way to do that, because then you're probably going to have a lot more things left alive at the end of it.
Yeah. And thinking about this on the other side, mm-hmm. being the attacking models, think about the order that you attack in.
Oh yeah.
Sometimes you just have to go, this thing has to attack first, or else I'll just lose too much. Mm-hmm. But in situations like this, where you have two units that are pretty strong in melee, right? Mm-hmm. you have, and like not likely to die, you know, to the backlash, especially if they both charge, like unless they're Slaanesh marked.
Yep.
You're going to be able to fight with both anyway. You can go, okay, there's not really a good way for him to remove models that's going to get the Abominant out of combat.
Mm-hmm.
So I should start with the Little Knight, and then I'll be able to do the Abominant after that.
Right. Yeah, because the Little Knight would have to kill three Terminators in this particular image. Like two or three Terminators. And that just doesn't feel...
And even then, like the ones in the back are probably close enough for the Abominant to reach, right? Like, yeah. It just depends. Just keep an eye on it and make sure. Because it's like, it's hard to really position your units. So you can be like, if he kills a couple, he'll be out of combat. But like, once you've positioned yourself and you see that situation come up, like make sure you're accounting for it and can use it.
Yeah.
Cause you can save a lot of models by just pulling stuff out of combat when it dies.
Yep. Absolutely. Now, one other quick thing I want to mention here is that when you're done with your consolidation move, which is what I'm about to talk about, let's just talk about it. So consolidation moves, again, you have to have been eligible to fight. You have to have piled in and then either fought or didn't. Like, you can charge and then your target's already dead, so you can pile in and consolidate still. That's fine. But you're allowed to consolidate after your combat. And if you are the one doing that to another unit that hasn't already fought, the thing that you almost always want to do is to touch their bases so they can't move. Because if you let them move, they can potentially move up to 6 inches. This is why you want to leave yourself as much wiggle room as possible when you finish your charge, because the only stipulations are must be closer to closest enemy. So if you are 1 inch away and then you end your movement 0.75 inches away, you're still closer. And so you can do a lot of lateral movement around the thing you're attacking, get into combat with other things, get out of combat, lots of different tricks there. But if you touch their base at the end of it, they don't get to move. And that's really important because you don't want to let them do the same thing back to you. But yeah, like between models that are charging and don't die instantly, should be getting their speed plus 2d6 plus 6 inches of movement out of the turn, which is a lot more than people tend to think it is. You can steal objectives with it. You can do all kinds of things. And in fact, in bigger units, go ahead.
I was about to say, one of the sneaky things about Demonettes that makes them so good is the 6-inch consolidate strat.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that you have a unit that can charge something, pile in 3, and then consolidate 6, and it's 10 models with OBSEC, like they will just steal objectives from you.
Well, and that's how Harlequins
that they were not anywhere near.
Function, yeah. Right? Yeah. Like there's mm-hmm. Twilight, yeah, Harlequins get 6-inch pile-ins and consolidates.
Yeah.
So, and they can move through models all the time and terrain.
Yeah, it's I guess it's like the thing is just remember, because I think a lot of people don't think about this, is that like moving is moving, right? And moving is great. Like moving your models around, getting more table space is a huge deal. Piling in is also more moving, and consolidating is more moving.
Mm-hmm.
Like use it for the movement that it is, and you can get a ton out of it.
Yeah, 100%. So let's talk about interrupting real fast, because this is a 2CB stratagem that everybody has access to. Unless you're fighting last, you don't get to do this if you're fighting last. but interrupting, a lot of people use to just like kill something or to weaken something. But I think the actual strongest thing to do with it is one of the following. Either to go steal an objective or something that you didn't have before, because you're able to move with your pile in, fight, and then consolidate onto the objective, and suddenly your opponent's in problemville. Plus you can base their thing before they get to pile in and consolidate, so they can't move it. So that's one. Two, if your opponent has specifically other units within 4 inches of your guy that can be gotten to while still moving closer to the thing they're in melee with, you can then do delightful switcheroos where you get your model completely out of combat with the thing that charged it and probably live. And there's, you know, that just cannot be understated how strong that is, as far as like, you charged my, I don't know, dreadnought, right? I interrupted with it, piled into a cultist unit or whatever, like even just like a legionaries unit, right? Instead of a bunch of Terminators with power fists. And I consolidated away from your Terminators. Bye. Right? Like, even if the Terminators can pile back into melee with it, you get, like, two Terminators fighting me now, maybe? Instead of all of the Terminators fighting me now, which is a huge deal. And maybe I've stolen back an objective. Maybe I've cut off your ability to move to a place now. Maybe I've based this thing that was definitely going to pile in and steal my objective and now can't do that anymore. Right? So it's two CPs. It's a lot. And a lot of people will rightfully just use it to kill stuff. But there's a lot of nuance to that particular stratagem that I think is worth exploring.
Yeah. Makes sense.
So when everybody has fought and all the moving is done, the fight phase is over. And there's a lot going on in there.
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, in a lot of respects, it's an incredibly complicated between the charge and the fight phase. It's a very complicated part of the game. Mm-hmm. Pretty much every other section is very much like, I mean, there's little things you can do about optimizing, like shooting and things like that. But like command phase is you're going to do your command buffs. And there's some tricks about the order of that. But most of the time, doesn't really matter that much.
Mm-hmm.
Like shooting, you move and then you shoot your guns. Right. Mm-hmm. Like it's pretty, there's not a lot of interaction. Whereas fight phase is where the game becomes highly interactive. Right. Like both players, especially when there's like multiple units charging in, both players become very involved in what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of moving parts. So,
yeah. It is super fascinating, and I think, honestly, like, part of why I love it so much is because the more elite your army is, the more you get to abuse it, because the easier it is to do tricky, movie, steely out of combat things.
Yeah, when you're used to, like, knights, right, where you have, like, one model, you're like, okay, I got a lot of weird things I can do with a single entity, right?
Oh, but it works great. Like, I've had really good success with it already in
Ghost Codes. Custodies as well, yeah.
Just like, all right, well, my bikes were here, and now they're not in combat with you anymore. Bye!
Yeah.
So good. I mean, even if, like, at the end of the day, you get to unengage yourself and that's it, like, that's great. That's so good. And there are ways to do that.
Yeah.
Or unengage the thing you want to shoot at next turn. That can also be huge.
Yep. Yeah, definitely. Cool. Well, there's a fight phase. In case you ever weren't sure how that worked, there's a nice, succinct, simple explanation of the fight phase.
Hour-long explanation.
We did it. Cool. Well, I think that's, unless you have anything else you want to bring up, it's probably bringing us to a close today.
Right. I think we got it about all in there. Yep.
Very cool. Well, I guess if you want to support us and the things that we do, you can go hit us up at patreon.com/lineofsightwargaming. And you can go to our website, which is lineofsightwargaming.com. You can see a whole bunch of articles, stuff like that, for various games, things of that sort. You can hit our Discord. You should be able to find a link to somewhere. Where's our link these days?
Show notes.
Okay, still in the show notes. Yep. All right, don't have to change my usual spiel.
Nope.
Nice. Yeah. And you can find us on Facebook at Line of Sight. Give us a like on there. Shoot us a message if you want.
Important. We have a YouTube channel now.
We do.
Yeah.
Can you guess what it is?
It's youtube.com/lineofsight, I think.
I mean, that sounds right, but if it is Line of Sight, you'll be able to find it.
Yep.
And that's where this podcast, of course, goes up there if you're not already there.
Mm-hmm.
As well as some other things we've been putting up lately. So go check that out. I think that's about it, though. I guess we'll see you guys next time.
Bye.
Come to play, stay to slay. Back and forth, come and go. I'll tell you what you wanna know. How to set your trap, watch as I attack. Try to play the game, try to stay sane. Working that brain, hope it's not in vain. You can try to play it safely, but there's no way you can break me. Time to get ready, the foe is coming steady, and we'll give it all we've got. Keeping it light, but holding on tight. It doesn't matter if we win or not. Gotta give it your all, even if you fall. We came to fight a fair fight, but now there's nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. You can try, but I've got line of sight. You come and talk and smack, well, we ain't like that. Talk is cheap, hard work and skill is where it's at. Now when your men wilt, you best try not to tilt. And if you beat me, there's no need to feel guilty. I don't play too safely, and there's no one here to save me. Time to get ready, the foe is coming steady, and we'll give it all we've got. Keeping it light, but holding on tight. It doesn't matter if we win or not. Gotta give it your all, even if you fall. We came to fight a fair fight, but now there's nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. You can try, but I've got line of sight. Did you think you could get away this time? Can't try. I've got line of sight.